Today my topic is a play on words, and I'm saying your choices are patience or patience. The first patience is the virtue of patience, which most of us can understand on some level, and the other patience is what you would find in a doctor's office, emergency room, or in a hospital. I think those things are mutually exclusive. I've always thought of patience as being about the relationship a person has with time and rhythm. I thought that a patient person was calmly aligned with the movement of time, and they weren't trying to make things happen in a different speed than other people would. An impatient person was a person who was fighting with time and fighting with rhythm and wanted things to happen in a different speed. As I think about the relationship, I realize that maybe birth could have been the first time that we physically experienced the concepts of time and rhythm, physically. So just think of that. We're being born, and of course a lot of things are talked about at that point relative to time and rhythm. The contractions, it's taken too long, or the certain number of minutes between contractions and so on. Undoubtedly, our mothers had feelings about how long their pregnancies were and about our movement in the womb. You know, feel this. The baby is kicking. The baby is kicking. The baby is moving up. It's turning around. It doesn't like me lying on my back. I have to turn to one side or the other. But being born probably intensified and imprinted specific feelings about time, about rhythm, about pain, and about discomfort. Because I attach a lot of significance to our birth experiences, I believe they shape us mentally, emotionally, and physically throughout life unless we deal with them some energetic way or therapeutic way. And so I'm inclined to see that our capacity for patience as being formed at birth. Having spoken to clients about their birth process, you can notice they have relationships. I can recall a client that was talking about his mother had a stillborn, the first child, and so she was really concerned with the second one. And it was a very, very long labor. And she blamed the child, the son, for that labor being so long and difficult. That client is enormously impulsive, not given to doing anything that's planned or methodical. So basically everything is impulsive. But patience is not really only about time and rhythm. It's also about our capacity to withstand, I'll say, non-desired energies without becoming unbalanced. And the way we often become unbalanced is we're driven into anger or complaining or other reactions like that. So if we can maintain equilibrium or a balance, that is largely considered to be a demonstration of patience. You can imagine that somebody who is patient and who displays patience, and I'll call it a quiet, steady perseverance. You know, they're persevering in what they want, but they're doing it quietly. They're not hostile. They're not making drama. Those people create very little resistance in other people, and it would indicate that that level of quiet persistence and perseverance would indicate that they don't have a lot of resistance in themselves that they're battling. They're moving toward what they want patiently. When you think of aging, I would guess that an older person with more life experiences is likely to be more patient than, say, a younger child who is just learning the ropes of life and the idea of how long it takes from the expression of a want or a need until the satisfaction of that want or need occurs. And we're learning all of that, but I'm thinking older people, see that patience is a virtue. And probably, I'm guessing, that we're more patient because we have lots of experience practicing with impatience and recognizing no matter how impatient we got, even as children we have tantrums and the tantrum doesn't produce results. And then we rant and rave at God and the world and howl at the moon and it doesn't produce any results. So over time we go, you know what? Impatience is really counterproductive. It breaks a lot of glass, it riles a lot of people, makes them resistant, and it's a waste of energy in most cases. It's almost as if we could have learned in the course of our life that being impatient is kind of like putting your foot on a gas pedal in your car. Your car is running, but it's standing still, and you put your foot on the gas pedal, and all the time your car is in neutral. It is not engaging, it's not making forward progress. The engine, of course, when you do that, it's working very hard, very hard. It's straining to move, but it's in neutral. We haven't given it a direction, and consequently, we don't make any progress. If we do that enough times, we're going to destroy that vehicle. And I think it works the same way with the human body. When we redline, when we put a tremendous amount of pressure and force and impatience trying to force something to happen outside of its normal sequence of time or rhythm, that we are straining the human body. I've given this opinion a bunch of times in these talks that I believe we manage four things: matter, energy, space, and time. Matter is solid stuff. Energy is not solid stuff. Space is the space around us, our personal space. It's our mind share. It's desk space, office space, closet space, refrigerator space, that sort of thing. And time, the 24 hours that all of us have every single day. But I'm going to say it a little bit differently now. Not only do we manage that, sometimes we have to put up with matter, energy, space, and time. It's these things are also being managed or maybe mismanaged by other people, not just us. So we have to put up with it. So when you have to put up with matter in your home or in your office or out in your car or on the road or any other place that you may go, how do you respond to that? How do you react? With patience or with resistance, rejection, conflict? When we have to interact with energy, well, let me just go back to matter. Here's a, I don't know why we call it pet peeve. It's not pet. It's so annoying as hell. I don't like litter. I don't like litter. So let's just look at that. Litter is matter, right? It's solid stuff. It's thrown on the ground or on the side of the road. How do you feel when you see litter or see somebody throw a cigarette butt out the window? It's not right for people to do that, right? I don't think it is. And I react to it, and I react with impatience. When we see matter in ways that don't align with or agree with our world view of what's right and what's good, I think littering is not good. I think putting trash in waste baskets is good. So when we see something that's out of alignment with our worldview, what reactions do we have? How do we feel about that? Do we get angry? Do we get frustrated? Impatient? Or are we in a place where we can recognize that all human behavior is orchestrated by the consciousness of each individual patient, each individual person? Now, I would love to be like that all the time. Sometimes I can, but a lot of times I can't. In that case, if we did, we would consider the awareness level as being the issue, rather than the fact that litter is itself the issue. It's the awareness of the person who thinks, okay, or doesn't think, and just throws trash out the window. It's like, wow. I'm guessing it is the lack of understanding on the part of the litterer that really needs to be addressed. They need to be helped to become more aware. And that's probably the solution, or the required solution, for lots of different problems. So, do we put up with other forms of matter in our own environments? How do we react to that? We can blame litter, maybe going down the road. Oh, that litter, whoever did that, that jerk. We can blame it on the other guy. But what about the objects that we have control over in our space, in our environment, those things? What is our relationship with them? Some people might go, procrastination. No. Procrastination is not patience. That's a different thing. For people who have to mow their lawns, for instance, when does the lawn need to be mowed? What time schedule or what appearance or what length of grass dictates that it's time for mowing? And you can see, it's like, I got to manage my lawn. So something is triggering, something is going to activate the next action. In the summertime, maybe it's like, there's warm weather, there's rain. I can't go 2 weeks. 2 weeks is too long because the grass looks shaggy. And what? That's not my worldview. A lawn shouldn't look shaggy. It should look neatly groomed. Okay? So maybe the answer to that is 1 week. Every week, a person needs to mow the lawn. Maybe that's the right amount of time. And it's like, okay, I mowed the lawn yesterday, and next Friday or Saturday, I'm going to mow the lawn again. And so we've got patience in between. We're not on Sunday night or Monday morning or Tuesday morning. We're not going, uh-oh, is it time for me to mow again? We've already scheduled it. We set that in motion. And we know, come next Saturday or Sunday, we're going to mow the lawn again. And we're like, are you patient? Well, I've organized time, so I'm not stressing about it. So maybe that makes us more patient. I don't consider myself overly controlling with regard to matter or people. However, for years, I confessed to this belief. I believe in two rules: gravity and slower traffic move right. And I joked about it, but I was actually serious about it. I wanted to control how other people drive their cars. I want slower drivers to move right. I mean, I see signs. I think it's etiquette, it's courtesy, and it makes sense to do that. And I want drivers to signal when they change lanes or when they plan to make turns. That's what I want. Slower traffic, move right, signal when you're changing lanes or making turns. There. Oh, one other thing. I want drivers to stop their car before they get to the crosswalk when they approach a stop sign or a stoplight. Let the pedestrians have the crosswalk. And when people pull into that, I go, that violates my worldview. That's not how driving is done, people. Now, I didn't make those rules. I obey them, and I honor them, and I like them, and I wish they were enforced. But these are standard common sense, standard common courtesy, common safety-oriented rules of driving. But I don't actually look at it as an awareness thing. It is, but that's not how I look at it. I get impatient with these people when I see these violations. And even though I know intellectually that, you know what, their violations are a lack of awareness, and guess what? My impatience is a lack of awareness. Both of them are. They don't know how to act. I know how to act, and I'm still acting inappropriately. I am not going to be able to control other people's driving with my impatience, because, frankly, they don't know about it. And the only person's body who has experienced the difficulty of this impatience is me. It's like, wow. So what I'm doing is not helping them, not helping me. It's only harmful to me. So I'm practicing impatience in that regard. Yesterday I was in a swimming pool. Now, I don't pee in a swimming pool for obvious reasons, and children need to get taught that, and for the most part they do. And when you turn around and say, okay, what's that got to do with anything? Well, I believe that we exist in an ocean of good, in an ocean of God, in an ocean of consciousness. So just think of that swimming pool enlarged. But here I am, mindlessly dumping the vibration of impatience, which is a low vibration. It's conflicting. It serves nobody. I'm pouring this into this ocean. That cannot be a good thing. Instead of elevating human consciousness, I'm contributing to its decline by polluting this ocean. Interesting way to look at it. We know that we experience environmental signals at incredible speeds and in incredible quantities. If these two statistics are accurate, they're amazing. That the conscious mind can process about 4,000 bits of information per second, and the subconscious mind can process 4 billion bits of information per second. That's a lot of information. And a lot of seconds go into a minute, and an hour, and a day, and a month, and a year, and a lifetime. Lots of information. We see things. That's how environmental signals come in. We hear things. We touch things. We taste things. We smell things. And cognitively, we just know certain things. And all of those are common processing methods. That's how we process information. Putting up with signs, putting up with sights, putting up with sounds, putting up with the things that we hear, putting up with the things that we touch and smell or taste. That's an interesting concept. Putting up with. When we're criticized, those words, spoken or perhaps written, were weapons. They were weapons coming to us. So it's like, if we have enough experiences of words being used as weapons, it's going to tend to make us reactive. When people say things to us, or say things to others, or write things either to us or elsewhere, like on Facebook, and if we disagree with those things because we're defensive based on our previous experience, incoming words, painful. I gotta protect myself from this. Somebody else who is physically abused is likely to be, I gotta protect myself from somebody getting too close to me. I gotta protect myself from that. All of this stuff could be triggered feelings of helplessness. We hear things. If we've got a sensitivity to the spoken or written word, what people say has hurt us in the past, and now we're hypersensitive to that, or at least hypervigilant. We go, somebody is dishonest, somebody is misleading or devious, and we hear this kind of stuff, hyperbole, and we're like, yeah, that's bad. That doesn't fit into my worldview. That violates my values. And we get all upset about it. We get all righteous about it. But the problem is, it's not our worldview that really counts when somebody else is expressing themselves. They're expressing their self-interest, their need to get their needs met, what they want and how they're trying to get it, based upon their level of awareness. So if you go into a certain situation in business, for instance, and you discover that the person is not telling you the truth, you go, oh, wow. They're operating for the benefit of their self-interest and according to their level of awareness. It's up to us to be able to understand what their level of awareness is. And if they're a caveman, if they're a thief, if they're a liar or an embezzler or worse, we're going to want to know that. Being patient gives us an opportunity to receive the information and process it more effectively. If we're impatient, we're going to overlook what I would consider to be some very visible, observable signs about the nature of the people we deal with. If we're very patient, you're like, okay, I got it. This person is trustworthy or not. But when we're impatient, we're only thinking of ourselves and we're battling other people and we're pushing through the resistance that, number one, we imagine. Number two, it may be there, but now we're trying to get it without regard for natural rhythm and so on. I was talking about not being controlling of stuff and people. To a certain extent, I'm very controlling of communication. What people say when they speak it aloud, or when they write it, or when they claim certain things, that I get real controlling about that. Not that I didn't lie when I was a kid. I probably was an excellent liar. I think all kids have that skill set. But when you can't trust what somebody else is saying, it's like the ground you're standing on now has started to shake, and it creates tremendous insecurity. And if you're with somebody who has an unbelievable ability to say stuff that's not true, to make things up, or to present things that are not true, I consider that a threat. I consider that a threat. And it's very difficult for me not to to deal with it. I tend to speak up about that sort of thing. And, unfortunately, not patiently. When I look at this, and this is one of the things that occasionally makes me wake up early in the morning, to look at this underlying premise that what somebody else says or what somebody else writes is a threat to me. Even when they're not talking about me, they're just making a statement about the consistency of the moon, I make it about me. And when I make it about me, then I react. If we make things about us, and I think this is a fundamental characteristic of a problem, we have to make it about us. Otherwise, it's not really a problem. It could be a challenge, it could be a puzzle, it could be a mystery, it could be any number of things, but a problem is because we take it and make it personal. It's like, but if I could get to the place that I recognize more than just intellectually that a speaker or a writer is actually expressing his or her self-interest according to their level of awareness. Has nothing to do with me. It's just, it's like looking at or listening to a photo or a video. It's like, And then I could determine that I want to get closer or further away from that person. Because the reality is, they are not expressing your level of awareness or my level of awareness. They're expressing their level of awareness. But my impatience is disclosing my level of awareness, which is, of course, to be impatient, your level of awareness goes down. So I'm not bragging, in fact, just the opposite. I'm saying when I'm impatient or anybody else is impatient, our level of awareness, it's really a dumbing down process. And depending on what we aspire to, you know, if you aspire to a higher level of awareness, which I do, you're like, oh, that's the wrong direction. Impatience is taking me in the wrong direction. Patience will take me in the right direction. That's where I want to go. But it seems pretty obvious that we don't like certain sights, we don't like certain sounds, we don't like the touch of certain things. Little babies, and I even recall this, little babies tend to like the satin I don't know if it's called bunting, the satin trim on a little blanket, right? It's so smooth. It's so smooth. Babies like that. I always liked that. Even as growing up, I had blankets like that as a teenager, I think, on our beds at home. And, you know, that's nice. Adults, and you can hear this, and maybe you could even relate to this, dislike certain textures in food. I've had people say to me, I don't like mushrooms. I don't like eggplant. I don't like tomatoes. And then I question, is it the texture? Is it consistency? I don't like that. And you go, sure, that makes sense. That makes sense. When you really think of it, it's kind of amazing to consider all the preferences that we have established in our lives. I mean, it'd probably be mind-boggling to just go, what kind of weather do you prefer? What kind of clothes? What kind of socks? What kind of underwear? What kind of shoes and shorts and what kind of blouses? What kind of this? What kind of that? What kind of food? What kind of do you prefer? What kind of chair? What kind of car? What kind of? Whew. We have preferences, and our worldview is created of these preferences, and at the same time, our belief in, I'll say, the availability of those preferences. And you go, yeah. However, patience is something that we're going to want to be able to access when we think or feel or speak and act and notice our preferences are not available. Then what do we do? Then what do we do? I think that's such an important question. Is I bet we could even develop or determine a success potential quotient, whatever that means, success potential quotient for a person, for ourselves, just by understanding the answer to these questions. How do you react when you don't get what you want? And if you saw children, right, you saw children in action, you'd say, well, I see they give up, I see them get angry, I've seen tantrums, I see repetitive, can I have? They continue reaching for what they want. So those three, you know, anger and giving up or continue to reach for it, that's like, okay, cool, that's a good thing. How do you react when you have to put up with something not to your liking? You can't have your preference. You have to have something that is not your preference. How do you react? How do you react? And some people do the same thing again. They give up. They get angry. They run away. They battle. And we're going to have those experiences a lot of times in life. And really, the name of the game is, if we can understand a mature, reasonable, high-level, patient way of dealing with them, we're going to be better. Two more questions. How do you react to discomfort? And I'm talking about physical discomfort, emotional discomfort, or mental discomfort, or all of the above. How do you react? Some people will not do anything if there's the least likelihood of those discomforts. But if you look at people going to the gym, or you look at people who are working out or exercising, or people who have achieved high levels of excellence in sports and anything else, you know that they have gone through high levels of discomfort because they recognized on the other side of that discomfort is their goal. And in fact, they increase their capacity to the point where this isn't really discomfort. It's no big deal. Whereas we might see it as a calamity. Oh, that's torture. That's a real problem. Oh, that's very difficult. Oh, my goodness. But other people that work at this recognize that this is an easy way to go. When you look at a professional tennis player or a football player or a basketball player, you know their relationship with discomfort is far different than yours and mine. And you'd go, they didn't get overwhelmed by discomfort because they had some sort of vision that down the road this could actually serve them. And then finally, how do you react to inconvenience? Inconvenience. We spend a lot of time as human beings trying to assure our comfort and convenience. And when we don't have the convenience, how do we react? Depending on how a person would answer those four questions, I bet they are related to that person's level of success. If those things are real, real problems, size of Mount Everest, or maybe gaps and abysses like the Grand Canyon, like, I couldn't get out of bed, it was too uncomfortable, you know, couldn't do it. Like, okay, I couldn't make that phone call, too difficult. Okay. I couldn't write that paper, couldn't make that presentation, okay. I think not only that, but the answers to those questions are going to show us how much resistance we have erupting in our field. I want to do something. That resistance is going, I'm going to protect you from reaching. I'm going to protect you from this discomfort. I'm going to protect you from this inconvenience. I'm going to protect you from this unknown, unpredictable mystery that you're about to go into. That will impede our progress. That's like slamming the foot on the brake. Not really what we want. If I were to draw a horizontal spectrum of patience and impatience, I'll put patience all the way to the right, impatience all the way to the left. And you go, okay. And I think as we move up and we're more and more patient with ourselves and others and time and rhythm, our resistance is going to decrease. As we move to the left and we move into impatience, we don't like how things are and we want to battle them, we're now in conflict, our resistance is going to go up. And if our resistance goes up because we've gravitated toward impatience, we're going to turn our efforts into struggle. You go, oh my, that's not what we have in mind. No, I think that impatience is oftentimes a habitual act. It's an act that gets triggered in response to feelings of helplessness. It's like, I feel helpless, boom. Pretty soon it's a rant that is trying to make things be different. It's trying to give us a sense of being empowered and powerful as compared to the helplessness that we've experienced just moments ago. Dealing with helplessness, it is so much better if you can find a direct method of responding to that helplessness. And I would suggest that very few things are better than being patient, because patience will then allow the best next action to be able to come into our awareness, and boom, without resistance, we would have received the dividend of that patience. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveal Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, We know that you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness. And as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.